All right. This is Bruce Budden recording an interview on January 30th, 2019 with David Hillman at Vancouver Island Persons with HIV AIDS Society. So, welcome. Thank you for coming in. And I'm going to ask you some questions. Actually, I already know the icebreaker. So, where are you from? Where did you grow up?
In Ontario. Chatham, small town between Windsor and London.
Okay.
I used to work there.
Oh.
Oh.
And when did you come to Victoria?
In 78.
Wow. Okay. That was a year after I was born.
Oh. I didn't know you then.
No. I was in Portmagee. So. You came here in 78. When did you first start to hear about HIV?
I was actually in the early 80s. I can remember where I worked. We got a journal called Science. This is a big international publication that comes out every week. And there was a letter to the editor that I remember reading about, and it was just a point of interest that the CDC in Atlanta had been recording unusually high numbers for a very rare pneumonia, which there would have been maybe 25 cases a year in the whole US, and the number had like quadrupled, but they were being clustered in Los Angeles, New York, and San Francisco, and they were mostly among gay men in their late 20s, early 30s, and they really, well, the letter was written as just a point of curiosity as to, I wonder what's going on here, and then it wasn't until, well, with time, we found out what was going on, but I still remember reading that letter in the magazine.
And
then it was in the news constantly as they found out more and more about what was going on. So it was in 1988. It was just inundating the news so much, I thought, oh, I should just go get a test, get it over with. I never, ever thought that I would be a candidate because I knew my own history better than anybody else. So I went to the STI clinic. And in those days, I think the test, it had to be sent to Ottawa. So it took a long time to get the results back. So I went in and the doctor said, well, you're positive. And I thought, really? There must be a mistake. And he said, well, I don't think so. And I just, I couldn't wrap my head around it. And he said to me, well, I guess if you smoke, you should quit smoking, and if you drink, you should quit drinking. And that was his only advice. And I went home and I was just kind of stunned, thinking, I can't believe this, so I went home ignoring his advice. I think I chain smoked a whole pack of cigarettes from that until I went to bed that night. I couldn't grasp the meaning of it. So I got a book and started reading about it, and I thought, well, I mean, from what I had read in the newspaper and in this introductory book I got, most of the cases in the U.S., these men were like walking pharmaceuticals. I mean, they were on massive amounts of recreational drugs every weekend. They were having thousands of sexual partners. And I thought, geez, in Victoria, you couldn't even do that if you were a professional. And I know my own history. I wasn't anywhere close to 1,000 or even a tiny fraction of that. So, You know, and these were the days when there was still a lot of judgment, and you know, there were the innocent victims and those who, you know, deserved it, and this, so there was a lot of stigma even in those days. And then when I was reading this book, and it started talking about the seroconversion illness, and I do distinctly remember having that, because it was on, I didn't know what it was at the time, but this is kind of backdating. It happened on New Year's Day in 1985, and it was such an unusual illness. I think I was out of work for 3 weeks, and I phoned up work the next day, and I just said, I'm not coming in, I'm really, really sick. And everybody laughed and thought, oh, you just partied too hard on New Year's Eve. And I said, I didn't even go out. And, you know, they characterized it as a flu-like illness. And I thought, well, I've had the flu, and this wasn't anything like the flu. I don't even know how to describe it, but for 3 weeks, I just wanted to crawl under a pillow and just wait for it all to go away. And I went to the doctor after, and we just had a regular blood test, and he said, well, your white blood cell count is very low, so you've had a viral infection. And by that time I was better, so I just thought, okay, no problem, I'm better now. And then it was, it was after I had the diagnosis and reading this book. And by that time I had met a few people who had HIV, and in those days, well, also I should back up and say, when I found out, when I had the seroconversion illness, I was also involved in a long distance affair with somebody in Vancouver for about 6 months who had lived in San Francisco in 1982, but nobody was connecting the dots. So, but he did complain that he was not feeling well a lot, although he looked fine. In those days, in Vancouver anyway, the only way you knew if anybody had AIDS was they either had Kaposi's sarcoma all over their body, which was a big visual cue, or they had wasting. But otherwise, you had hundreds of people with HIV who looked perfectly normal and healthy. There was no test in those days. Test didn't come out until later. So people just carried on. And then, so when I was reading this book, and I just thought, well, maybe some people just do better than others. Maybe I, for whatever reason, because by that time I had recovered and I was doing fine. So I didn't really give it another thought. And then the year later, this was about 1989, I came down with shingles. And by that, I was like 36.
I was gonna actually ask if we could maybe move it, because sometimes when you put your chin down, it covers it. Sure, where to put it though? Can we like pinch a fold right here? Yeah, that'll work. Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
So, in 1989, I came down with shingles, and I went to my doctor, and he was out of town, so he had a locum, fresh out of med school, and I don't think she ever had seen a case of shingles. Certainly not in somebody so young. And she thought it was a bacterial infection and sent me home with a bottle of Physohex, which that was a popular antibiotic wash. And the things just got worse, so I went back the next day, and the blisters were out of control, and she sent me down to see a dermatologist in the same building, and he knew instantly, oh, you've got shingles, which is unusual for somebody in their mid-30s to have shingles. It's usually among seniors. And he said, oh, it'll go away on its own, or you can take Zovirax. And I just thought, okay, if it's going to go away on its own, it will. And then reading this book that I got, it did mention that shingles was one of the most common manifestations of HIV. So at that point I thought, oh well, because I had not told my general practitioner about any of this. It was just done at the STI clinic. The records are confidential. I thought, well, I'm okay. I don't need to tell my GP. But at that point I did tell him, and then he said, well, I need a record of it, so you have to go back and have another test, and so that the records will go into my files, because he couldn't access anything at the STI clinic because it was all private. So I did that again, and then he was on the verge of retirement, so he had no clue what to do. So he sent me to infectious disease doctor who I think at the time was the only one in Victoria who mostly dealt with tuberculosis, but he was getting the HIV cases. Because
what year was that in?
About 89. And that experience was I thought, oh, he'll know what to do, he'll fix me up. And I don't know what I was expecting, but his attitude was, he was so clinical, and I'm coming in as a traumatized patient thinking I'm going to die at any minute. And he was looking at me like just a disease that needed to be dealt with, a medical problem on two legs, rather than this traumatized patient who I guess was looking for a little bit of, not sympathy, but just some kind of understanding. But and anyway, there wasn't much he could do anyway, because there wasn't much to do. And then I remember that it was about 1990, AZT became available as an experimental drug, and it wasn't even a clinical trial. There was so much pressure, certainly in the United States and Canada, for anything. And so I guess, was it at the time, the company GlaxoSmithKline had it at, no, Burroughs Wellcome. I think it was Wellcome. They've changed so many times. Anyway, they made it available to anybody who wanted it. So we were all volunteered to be guinea pigs. And so I thought, well, I'm not quite sure, because I've read good and bad things. So I phoned up AVI, and I wanted to talk to a couple of people who've been on this so I could make a decision. And I talked to two people who had completely contradictory experiences. One said, oh, it saved my life. And the other was, oh, I've never been so sick in my life on this. So I thought, oh, well, that's, how am I supposed to make a decision on this? So I thought, well, I'll try it. So at that point, there was a clinic, an outpatient clinic at the old St. Joseph's Hospital, where they... You're too young to know where that
probably.
Was. You know where it was, probably.
Yeah,
the old, what used to be the old general. And that had, after the new general had moved out, the old building was used for just, supplementary stuff. So they put like an HIV clinic in there, because practically nobody ever used that building. So that's where I picked it up. And after 2 weeks of this stuff, and like I said, we were all guinea pigs. Nobody knew the correct dose or whether it would even work. And after 2 weeks, I was so sick and nauseous all the time. I said to the nurse, if this is the cure, I think I'd like to take my chances. And I stopped taking it. And within 48 hours, I just felt so much better. And I guess the upshot was, after this kind of experiment had finished, they dis- discovered that the dose they were recommending was double of what it later was dosed at. So
wow.
I think that's why so many people got so sick on it. So I thought, okay, well, that's that. I'm not going on that again. And at that time, it was around that time that I was dealing with a lot of like health issues, mostly primarily just this crushing fatigue. That was the big manifestation with me. I had terrible sleep disorders, you know, not being able to get to sleep until like 2 or 3 in the morning, and then having to get up and go to work, and then sleeping in often, working late. And it was just, I got to the point where I thought, I'm going to kill myself if I end up trying to just force myself into going to work. So I quit in, when was it? August of 1990, I think. Yeah, I just couldn't handle it anymore, and it took me almost 10 months to just recover in the sense of getting my strength back. To me, my biggest hurdle was this crushing fatigue all the time. I could hardly get through the day without having 3 or 4 naps. And then when I got on my feet, I ran into an old acquaintance who was coming out of the building where my infectious disease doctor worked. And I knew him from years ago in Calgary. And anyway, he phoned me up that night, because I guess I didn't even know he lived in Victoria, but my name was in the phone book. So he said, well, what were you doing in that building? What doctor were you seeing? And I told him, and he said, oh, so you've got it too. And at that point, I hadn't told anybody, but I mean, he'd figured it out.
Yeah.
2 gay men going into a clinic where the only infectious disease doctor in town worked, you know, putting 2 and 2 together. That's probably why I was there too. So at that point, he was doing some volunteer work at AVI, but he was trying to get up a little support group of just positive people to meet on their own for, you know, like a, I guess, what was the buzzword in those days was empowerment. And AVI was more like a group of social workers looking after people. And I thought, well, I can look after myself, thank you. I don't need that. But he managed to get a room at the YMCA once a week. And there was a small group of people who regularly showed up, and we'd just talk about, you know, what we were doing to stay healthy, what pills we were taking. I think by that time DDI had come out and I was on that. And in these days, everything was monotherapy and most things worked for a while. You know, you don't know how long, and they had a variety of side effects that some DDI was a drug that I did quite well on. I had no real issues, no issues that I was aware of. It did have, it was pretty heavy on the pancreas, but that was not something I was aware of. Anyway, I did quite well on it for a few years, and then like most of the drugs in those days, they kind of seemed to wear off, and then you'd be right back at square one. Anyway, so we would meet every Friday at the Y and just talk about how we were doing, and we would have socials after, and it was just a nice little way to connect with other positive people.
May I ask who was that organized that?
Oh, it was a fellow who, he went by the pseudonym of Windy Earthworm. No, very few people knew his real name, and I didn't either, but he was kind of a member of a group called the Radical Fairies. He was a gender bender way back in the 80s. He was a character. He was quite the character. But he was also a real social activist and a rabble rouser. And he was kind of the organizer behind all of this. And unfortunately, he died in, 93. But he was the one who really got the PWA Society here off the ground, and unfortunately died so early that almost nobody except me and maybe two or three other people actually remember him. There's not that many of us around from the early 90s. So he got it off the ground, and he managed to get a $20,000 grant, which seems like peanuts today, from the Ministry of Health, so we could open up a little office, which we did, and it was all volunteer. And the rent was cheap because the house was owned by this, well, the CRD, but they told us that it was, at some point in the future, it will be torn down for a social housing development, which it was. But we had it for, I think, a couple of years, and it was built as a duplex, but it had been empty for years, and we we took the main floor, and then Varks, which you were with. Yeah, and Varks was starting up almost at the same time, the Victoria AIDS Respite Care Society. So we said, well, why don't you move upstairs and we'll just share the rent, which made it even cheaper. So we had money for, you know, our telephones and mail, and I think we even got a computer when computers were just coming in. And we had a nice little setup. And you know, the rest is history for that. And for me, I found a niche there where I could be useful. And so after my health had somewhat recovered, I kind of threw myself into that and took it on almost as a part-time job. I mean, I have to tell you, I grew up in a family that had really strong work ethic. And the going on like disability, I had nightmares for months about, well, basically not working myself into the grave, because that's what it would have been. And people said, well, that's the whole point of insurance, you know, disability insurance. If you get disabled, you're not left out in the cold. I just had a hard time, you know, wrapping my mind about that and being comfortable. And I threw myself into this volunteer position to the point where I'm earning my disability pension, like as if I had to earn it or justify it in my own mind. But that's what I did in those days. Anyway, I found my niche, and I really enjoyed doing what I did. And you know, over the years, things just got more complicated. It started out as a volunteer organization where very small, but in most of these groups, as soon as you get more people coming in, you get more ideas, and then things don't always operate on consensus, and, you know, other opinions conflict with the people who were there first, and then you see all this hierarchy building up of, and you know, conflict. And well, I look back on that now, and you know, could we have done it differently? Yeah, but you know, I think the fact that we're still here after God knows what 26 or 7 years, I think, is, you know, we were persistent and we made it. It's despite a lot of struggles along the way, mostly internal struggles with just personalities and things, but we're still here. And I think all those conflicts from the 90s are now just, they don't exist anymore for a lot of reasons. So.
Can I ask what your niche was?
I started up the treatment library because in those days, well, there wasn't really hardly anything. As I said before, there were like 2 drugs on the market when we started up. So it was mostly trying to get a hold of newsletters from other agencies, mostly in the U.S. These were agencies that were started up by positive people for positive people who had newsletters written by positive people on, you know, the research, their research agenda, and what we could be doing to look after ourselves. So I was trying to, you know, this is before the internet was what it is today, subscribing to all these newsletters and then photocopying the articles and filing them by subject matter on what you could do with, you know, because people had a lot of like skin disorders and just a lot of little things that went along in the package with HIV. That, I mean, this stuff you don't see at all today because the meds take care of that and you just don't have all these continual set of minor problems, and nobody knew what to do with it. So anyway, I had amassed this huge file of information and then all the new drugs that were in development, and yeah, people accessed it, and we had a newsletter, and I would kind of summarize, you know, the monthly news that came out of all these sources, mostly New York and San Francisco. And then this was even before Katie started up, but then Katie too. And so just sort of little snippets of, my intention was always to keep it positive, which was different than a lot of people who were, especially HIV negative people. I don't know why they always emphasized how horrible the drugs were, side effects, you know, these drugs are going to kill you, and just the negativity. And I was trying to be every month to be upbeat, you know, like, we're making progress, you know, just hang in there, things will get better. So in spite of the fact of, you know, this other element was, you know, the sky is falling, but it did often feel like life was like standing on the edge of a cliff waiting for the bottom to drop at any moment, because there wasn't that certainty until maybe about 1996, when the big international conference in Vancouver, which I did go to, the first and only one. But in that one, we had two things that happened that completely turned the course of AIDS around, and that was the viral load test, which could actually measure how effective your drugs were, and the introduction of the protease inhibitors. And that was the game changer that changed everything. And, you know, I'd lost a lot of friends at that time, and I, you know, just it was sad, the ones who just couldn't hang on long enough until the protease inhibitors came out, because they would probably still be here too. And then, I mean, even the first protease inhibitors that came out, they were like the equivalent of AZT back in the late 80s. They were horrible. They came with a lot of side effects. I'm thinking of Sequinivir. And, you know, multiple times a day with all sorts of restrictions. And then it was in 96 when I think Sequinivir, or Crixivan, Indinavir came out. And that was just as complicated, but it had a better track record. And that was the drug that almost everybody went on in 96, 97, 98. Everybody was on Crixivan. But that wasn't an easy drug either. It was three times a day on an empty stomach. Your whole life had to be regulated around the pill schedule. And the company was giving out free dosettes and beepers and, you know, it was, in one sense, you were grateful to be alive, but in another sense, I mean, every day was determined by your pill schedule. If I went out for lunch, it had to be structured so that I would have my 2-hour period before 3:30, because there wasn't a lot of wiggle room. First thing in the morning, as soon as I got out of bed, pills. Middle of the afternoon, pills. Last thing I did before I went to sleep, pills. And then that went on for several years until I finally got drug failure, because I had been on after I had been on DDI for quite a while and I was failing that, so my doctor put me back on AZT, now that we knew the proper dose, which was half of what I had been on before, plus a new drug that had just come out called 3TC, and they were being combined. I guess at that point in the Center for Excellence was getting moving towards this theory that I wonder if two drugs work better than one. And yeah, they did. But again, not forever. So I went back on AZT with the 3TC. And when I had, I think I was on that for about 2 years. And then it was at that conference, when I came back to Victoria, the viral load test was now available at St. Paul's. And I had my first viral load test, and it was 27,000. So I knew, well, these drugs aren't even working anymore. Everybody else was getting undetectable, which that was the whole goal of treatment. And now we can show whether you had achieved that goal. So at 27,000, I thought, well, these aren't working. But there was nothing left for me to do other than this new drug, Indinavir, Crixivan. So at that time, we just added it on to a failing regime. And I think Crixivan carried me on its back for about 4 years until 2001, when I had drug failure. So it was a good drug for me, in spite of, you know, all the burden it carried with it. So then, I can remember that time. I came back from I had a workshop to go in Vancouver. I came back and, what was it? Oh yeah, I should say that while I was on the AZT, 3TC, and Crixivan, I did manage to go undetectable during the after my first test of 27,000 on two drugs. I became undetectable after we added the Crixivan. Then in 2001, I came back from Vancouver, and as soon as I got back, I came down with the norovirus, which, if you've ever had it, is pretty horrible, like the stomach flu. Awful. The next day I broke out in cold sores, herpes, and the day after that I came down with a cold. So I had like three viral assaults all at the same time. My next viral load test, it had gone from undetectable for about 4 years to 7,000 in 3 months. So I thought my immune system had simply been overwhelmed with these three viral assaults in a matter of 2 or 3 days, and my immune system must have collapsed. So anyway, I had drug failure, and my doctor, my ID specialist, said to me, well, what do you think we should do? And I thought, well, you're the doctor, not me. I said, I think you should send me over to Vancouver and let them figure it out, because you obviously don't know. So I went to Vancouver, and at that time they threw everything but the kitchen sink at you, you know, and having to go on five drugs. And I thought, oh my God. But you know, I didn't have much choice in the matter. So anyway, I did. And over since 2001, yeah, we have tweaked my meds over time, but I'm still on more than three, which is the standard. But you know, over that time period, it's just part of my life. I don't even think about it anymore. Pills at breakfast, pills at 9:30 a.m., 9:30 p.m., and that's my life. Just one more thing. Okay. There is, I know that there's a new drug. Oh, it's not a new drug. Health Canada approved a new formulation of old drugs, piled into a single tablet, which I'm waiting for to be put on the BC formulary, because I would qualify for that. I'm already on two of these three drugs, but to have everything combined into one single tablet once a day would make my life easier. So it's just a matter of, I mean, every province decides what it will and won't. I could get it right now if I wanted to pay for it myself, but I'll wait. So anyway, I'm looking forward to this. When it does come on the formulary, I'll probably get that. And my pill, I'll still be on the same number of drugs, but far less pills.
Yeah.
So,
well, that will be helpful.
That's my life in a nutshell. So,
I wonder more about how you were affected personally over time by the initial diagnosis, how your family reacted to it, how your love life changed over time between being diagnosed and going through all the different
periods. Oh, well, I was traumatized originally. I mean, as I said before, I couldn't wrap my head around this whole thing of being positive. My reaction was I just went celibate for several years. I just didn't know what to do. And thought, well, I should just avoid. I mean, this is how I got it. So I should just avoid this whole area for a while until I can figure out what to do. And I did, I was very selective in who I told. I mean, I did tell my supervisor at work, and she was very, very sympathetic. And I think after I left on short-term disability and then long-term, I think they all figured it out. I just said I had chronic fatigue syndrome, which basically that is what I had. I was chronically fatigued all the time. I just didn't go any deeper than that. And I told a few select friends here, and you know, and I said, you know, could you keep it to yourself? And of course, who could keep that to theirself? It's just such a major piece of gossip. So, but what annoyed me a lot was that a few people that I told, these were gay men, ended up dying of AIDS. They never, and I shared my journey with them for years, and I found out later none of them ever went for testing. Until they ended up in the hospital flat on their back with a diagnosis of AIDS because they had a major opportunistic infection. And I thought, what the hell's in your head? It's everywhere. You've heard my journey. Why didn't you go get tested? I guess they may have thought, oh, well, it doesn't affect me. Well, that's what I thought too about me. But I just assumed that everybody would be getting tested. But no, that's everybody wasn't getting tested. And there were a lot of gay men just saying, don't get tested because, well, there's nothing you can do about it, which was true. So you're going to be totally traumatized. And why put yourself through all this? Because you're going to die anyway. And the attitude in those days, well, why should I clean up my act? And some people said, well, I'm going to die anyway, so I might as well just party hardy. And that's exactly what they did. They partied till they dropped dead. And there was no, my attitude was, is there anything that I can do, you know, on my own to clean up my life, improve my health? You know, I guess I just had a very different attitude. And I do remember picking up a book. I can't even remember the author. It was by a doctor called The Will to Live. And he had been dealing with cancer patients and people with devastating diseases. So it wasn't a mind over matter, but it was like having a really intense will to live. Really contributed a lot to his patient's survival, as opposed to those who just, you know, it's my fate, I'm going to die anyway, and they did. You know, like a self-fulfilling prophecy. That wasn't my attitude. But anyway, back to these friends, I felt so angry. I mean, I went to their funerals and I thought, why the hell did you not do what I did? You know, after observing me sharing my journey with you. But Anyway, that was the attitude. There was a lot of attitude about there. You know, they didn't want the stigma, and there was a lot of stigma too, and a lot of judgment. So I just kind of, you know, isolated myself from that aspect. I wasn't really involved in the greater gay community. My community was the small group of positive people that we had collected at the center. Our first office was on Superior Street. That was my social group right there. I couldn't be bothered with, you know, the judgment and all the other stuff that went on in the larger gay community. And there was a lot of it, really bad. So,
You were obviously still aware of it, though. You were obviously still aware of it, though.
Aware of
the fact that you may not have been involved with them, but you could still heard about what was going on.
Oh, yeah. It was. And I told my parents, and I don't know, their reaction was very strange. I can still remember. I don't have a very close relationship with my parents, and my mother seemed to be more traumatized than I was. She was almost hoping that I had been using injection drugs. That was her first question.
That would be better than you being gay.
I said no, because I hadn't. I'd spent, since I was 18, I always lived thousands of kilometers away, and I did go back once in a while for a visit. But you know, I never talked about myself or my life, and they didn't ask questions either. So I am, you know, I'm pretty open with sharing people, but like, you got to ask me questions. I'm not one to just dump my life in your lap without you asking questions. So, but there was just this, I was always called tight-lipped, and it's also because they never seemed to take much interest in my life anyway. So that's why I never mentioned anything, but I really thought it's not fair to them to not tell them, because at that time I thought at some point I'm going to get really sick and die, so they should know now. And so they were upset, but it was like all the sympathy went towards my mother, not to me, because how she couldn't handle it. And anyway, I introduced them to a group of, there was a support group, I think it was an offshoot of VARCS, for parents and friends of people. It was like a HIV positive and equivalent of PFLAG. It was sort of parents and friends and others dealing with a friend or a child who had HIV. So I got them into that, and they were very good about it. They were fine. They adjusted. They told my sisters and all my nephews and nieces, and even the religious. I have one sister who's very religious, and they were all fine. Even my nephews and nieces were with everything, with the diagnosis. Well, I mean, that was a different generation of people too. And the fact that I had HIV, so there was no problem there. I kind of felt here I only needed to disclose to people who I thought needed to know. I wasn't one of these people. Like, I had a friend on one of the Gulf Islands who would wear a shirt saying, "Nobody knows I'm HIV positive." Or they'd have tattoos saying HIV positive with one of those biohazard icons on it.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I don't need to tell the whole world. I'll tell the people who I think need to know, but not casual acquaintances. They don't need to know any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I did, because, you know, gossip and judgment and all of that stuff. So anyway, I'm got to the point where I'm quite fine with it. I mean, now in 2018, having HIV is like, you know, it's like diabetes. Well, not really, but you know, it's just, it's a manageable thing. You just live with it. You do what you got to do and life goes on, and you're going to die. Well, at least people with HIV will die with it, but not because of it. So that's my attitude now. It's just, you know, I have the rest of my life to live, and so I'm going to live it. I'm really not as involved in, well, if there is an HIV community, I don't even know if there is one as such, not the same way as there was in the 90s, but I think a lot of us older, old-time survivors have just decided, well, okay, well, we're not going to die of that, so we might as well just get on with living the rest of our life. And that's what I've been doing. Although I still have a connection here, you know, I come in once a month just to do my own little thing in the library. I don't know if anybody uses it, but it's more for me, because I like to keep in the loop of what's going on. I sat on the Canadian HIV Trials Network for 10 years as a member of the community, where we, you know, would look at trials that were seeking funding, and we would give our input as a potential patients entering the trial. So that was one way I could keep in the loop and know what was going on, and that was fun. But after 10 years, I thought, okay, I've done my thing here. Now I want to move on to the next stage of my life. So yeah.
Sounds reasonable.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, HIV is not a career. I mean, especially if you have it. It might be a career if you make your living in it. But I wasn't making my living in it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just like, it's not a career. It's a step on the journey. So.
Yeah, pretty much all of these have been answered. Do you have any advice for health professionals?
Well, I would say I'm not really in the system as an HIV positive person that much. I see my, not the ID specialist I talked to before, he's retired. All of my doctors are retiring, and I seem to be outliving everybody. But my GP is fine. And the person who looks after my HIV stuff, I only check in with him about once every 16 to 18 months to tell him I'm still alive, in case you forgot. because there's nothing wrong with me that's HIV related. I see my GP maybe once a year, and that's for, I call it self-induced mechanical injuries from the gym. I don't have any HIV related problems anymore. I still get my blood work done maybe every 6 months. I get, when I go to see my HIV doctor, he does a full physical every 2 years, and I come, you know, I get a gold star. Everything is right where it's supposed to be. But, you know, I found things that work for me. I'm very much into approaching any health issues with, let me do lifestyle management first before I look at drugs. And so far, you know, in most cases it's worked. I had a doctor in Vancouver who wanted to put me on statins, and he put everybody on statins. And I said, look, I know how to read a blood test. You know, and I know, I'm not going to have a heart attack in the next 6 months. Let me see what I can do. And I got all my numbers back into a nice, comfortable position. And one thing I didn't say was that I had been, during this course, I'd come down with a serious clinical depression. I'd been dealing with this since I was in my 20s, you know, mild episodes, but it was back in the 90s when I had probably my first serious one. And the funny thing is it had nothing to do with HIV. It was just one of those things where, I don't know, life just seems to be overwhelming. And I managed to get through that by myself. And then in 2001, it was right around the time of 9/11. It had started about a month before that. That was the first serious episode where I had to go on medication. And I did that for about a year. And yeah, I came out of that, stopped the meds, and then about 9 years later, I had another episode, and none of this stuff was related to anything going on with HIV. And that episode, I was on, I don't know, three different meds before I found one that worked. And then I just stopped those meds almost accidentally about 6 months ago. I had gone on a half dose for I think almost 2 years, and then I went on a holiday, and I had my antidepressants with me, and I forgot to take them. So, and I didn't realize that for about 4 days, and I thought, whoops, I should maybe just take one every other day. And then I did that, and then I forgot again. And I thought, oh, to hell with it. I just stopped. And I'm fine. But I just found it curious because they say clinical depression is one of those things that's part and parcel with HIV. But I often question, is it because of the HIV? I mean, in my case, I wasn't obsessing on that. It was just one of those things where everything just seems to fall apart and there's no rhyme or reason and no triggering event. There's never been a triggering event. It's just one of those things. Hmm. So anyway, back to, you know, I've always been into lifestyle management for me is first and foremost. And when I've told people about my journey, a lot of them will just say, well, it's easier to take another pill. And it's like, okay, well, you can do that too. I think I like the challenge of seeing if I can change things on my own. But with depression, it's not something you fool around with. And I've done the 6 months of doing all sorts of, you know, the natural route, and it didn't help the least bit. But I think it's one of those things that, you know, even psychiatrists in the medical community, they don't really understand what's going on in the brain or anything like that. So medication worked for me, and I wanted that. The lifestyle management for me doesn't work with depression. It's very chemical bound. But with everything else, with, you know, cholesterol, triglycerides, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, I think I can try to work on that without any medication. And so far it's worked. Because with a lot of my meds and the fact that I'm getting older, you know, it's like an uphill battle, but so far I'm winning, you know, and because most of my contemporaries, whether they have HIV or not, because I'm going to be 70 this year, they're all getting high blood pressure, pre-diabetes, cholesterol, arthritis, you know, one thing after another. And it's just like, well, it's just the package. It's part of the package. And it's like, well, not necessarily. I mean, you can do things about that. But again, I get this, oh, just rather take another pill. It's easier. It's like, okay, well, go for it. So, anyway.
Do you have any advice for future generations that didn't have to deal with any of this kind of a
well,
thing growing up?
I mean, we know how HIV is transmitted. Pay attention. You know, I just thought after, you know, about, when was it in, when we started up in the early days, because we'd always be getting new people coming in recently diagnosed, and it's like, well, how could you not know? I mean, we're just inundated with information in those days. How could you not know? I thought, everybody knows how it's transmitted. And the usual answer was, well, I didn't think it would happen to me. And I'd say, well, why not? Why are you so special? You know, that's the answer. That's what I said to myself. Well, why me? And then, you know, well, why not me? You know, it only takes, you know, I don't want to call it a mistake, but when I got infected, there just was not the information that there is today. But, you know, you're young, you experiment, you know, you're just not thinking that this isn't going to be my problem, but until it is, and then it is your problem. Mm-hmm. So my advice is, you know, just pay attention to, you know, your, I don't know what, they don't cover this in high school anymore, but I would think anybody should know you don't share needles, and you, especially for gay men, you don't practice unprotected sex unless you're on PrEP. So, but that wasn't an option years ago, so.
Yeah.
And from what I hear through the grapevine, there needs to be more education, especially aimed at, you know, first generation immigrants and overseas students coming here who seem to be not aware that, you know, this disease is still there, and they come over with this expectation that, oh, well, there's a cure for everything, or it's not even discussed. They were born at a time when, you know, this, it doesn't exist. And so that's just, I have a friend in Vancouver who works as an outreach nurse in one of the clinics, and he said over 50% of the people coming in with an STI are either first generation immigrants or international students. Wow. They just have no clue, just no, because it's not discussed in the family, it's not discussed in the culture, and they think, oh, I'm gay, I've hit paradise where you can do anything you want and be out and be free, and then reality hits them in the face. So yeah. But I, you know, from what I hear, I mean, the healthcare system is so much more compassionate and educated for the most part. My only experience in the hospital, I did have pneumonia, but it was just, my doctor said it was garden variety. I don't, whatever that means. It wasn't PCP. And I found all the young nurses were, they were no problem at all. I only had problems with one older nurse who was kind of kept her distance and only did what she had to do and was kind of, I mean, it was very visible that she wasn't too friendly, and you know, like I was radioactive. So, but and this was, when was this, in 93, you know, but even then the young nurses in nursing school were getting educated, and they seemed to be, they had no problem dealing with HIV patients. It was the older ones who were still, you know, didn't want to get too close to the subject. So, but I think that's all gone now.
All right.
So, unless you have any more questions, I don't think I can think of anything.
Is there anything else that you can think of that you would like to say?
No, not really. I think I've talked myself out. I'm just glad I'm still here after... Yeah, since we're in 1985, I mean, every New Year's Day, it's kind of like, oh, this is my anniversary, and I'm still here after all these years.
Wow.
And even with this place, it's like, I never thought it would last this long, so,
yeah.
But we're still here, and we're still doing work. I mean, the work is very different from what it was in the early 1990s, but it's still obviously necessary work or we wouldn't get funded, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, thanks, David.
Okay. Thank you.